Good news, man. Bad news for the system is good news for me and you. Yeah, I like it. Happy days are here again, because it's all bad news on the TV for the system, not for us. You know, they're gonna. Republicans got a new budget they're about to pass. We're trying to pass, and if they pass it, it'll mean 3.2 million people will lose their jobs. They'll be out of work. Yeah, that's right. Are they telling you that on your Republican-controlled TV? No way. No way. They ain't talking about that. Hey, it's Terrible Tommy, and it's May the 6th, 2015. May the 6th. Wotan's Day, David Lane's favorite day. In other words, I have no use for either party, but the Republicans are bringing on another mini depression on top of the one we're already in. Yeah, did you know that? But I'll tell you one thing, they're not going to quit spending billions on defense. I'm so defended I don't know what to do. God, man, don't defend me anymore. I can't afford to be defended. I can defend myself. I got a pitchfork out there by my gate. Yeah, you know, don't laugh. Pitchforks are great. Hardly anybody ever want to come up against a man with a pitchfork, unless they got the gun, you know. Well, it's a beautiful day here in north central Indiana. Farmers are out planting their stuff, and looks good out there. It's warm, nice. You know, I got a bunch of bumblebees that come around here every spring. It's like they make a pilgrimage to Tom Metzger's house. And I go out there and stand with a half a dozen of them swarming around my head, and I'm never threatened at all, the bumblebee. In fact, you may find this weird, because I do a lot of things that are weird. Bumblebee will come up within 6 inches of my face, and I'll talk to him. I'll talk to him. Say, how you doing there, Mr. Bumblebee? I haven't seen you since last fall, you know. And so they hang out here. But bumblebees, they never bother me. I don't know. Maybe they bother some people. I know some people probably are scared of them. But you don't need to be afraid of a bumblebee. They just fly up there around your head and put her neutral and sit out there about 6 inches from your nose and look at you. I wonder what they're seeing. Let's see how the blow 'em up business is going. She wanted some good news. The military-industrial complex and all their military arms makers and everything. And they've spread these little plants around the country. Every congressman wants a cluster bomb factory in his backyard to keep all the Christians working. Yeah, no shit. So, yeah, let's listen a little bit of this. Come on. Yeah. Well, what's going on here?
Two countries are remarkable in the sense that they hate spending money on their own defense. They want the United States to do it. And you know what? There are plenty of defense contractors that would love to do that for their European allies because they buy American weapons here. So this is a really good arrangement for the Pentagon and its contractor friends where profits is only one way. It's up, okay? And that's, you know, it's quite disturbing because as we heard earlier in the program with Robert in Boston is that, you know, you build the bomb and you blow it up, okay? That's it. That's the end life of that, you know, the economic endeavor. But a bridge, if you build it right, can last a long time. If you educate a person right, they can add to the economy, pay taxes, etc., etc. So this, you know, this Keynesian militarism is not working for the United States. It's actually a dead weight on economic development and expansion. For most people, for the majority of people.
Well, I think the way it's structured in the United States, it helps thousands of small companies in terms of contracting. So a lot of out-of-the-way locations might actually flourish because of defense spending. But I would also add that our allies are part of the problem. They're the ones, for example, the French, who encouraged NATO and or elements of NATO to go into Libya. As a consequence, it created a whole new problem. I might add that Russians were very, very much against that. And what happened now is that Libya today is now a base for ISIS. So that creates a whole new generation of, if you will, for and need for that defense spending. And I would add that our other allies, like Saudi Arabia, in order to keep them in our little security structure that we and understanding that we have, they just bought $62 billion worth of American arms. And thirdly, you have most of the major countries, even Russia, their defense spending has also gone up, and including the United States. So it is on the rise, and even China is increasing dramatically in its own spending. And a lot of that, and particularly the French, even though they won't spend it on themselves, they are selling arms. They just spent they're just sending $3 billion of arms. And this is one of the reasons why Russia is modernizing its military. And I'll tell you, you read the American newspapers, and Russia adds 3 planes to its air force, and oh my God, Russian aggression is back when it never compares to what the U.S. does or some of its allies. You know, I'm really serious. You know, a couple of tanks, and you know, the world is coming to an end. Go ahead.
Well, I mean, if you want to compare Ukraine to what's going on in Yemen,
yeah.
I mean, the United States is clearly backing Saudi Arabia. They're going in a deposed president that wasn't even elected, runs away to Saudi Arabia, and they're bombing in Yemen. But I'd like to bring out the point that you were talking about military Keynesianism. The fact fact of the matter is the people, the world economy that supposedly all these wars, we're going to put aside this whole story of democracy for now on, but the real reason they're fighting is for world economy and resources. The fact of the matter is the thing that's going to be, the fact of the matter that's going to kill the world economy again is the fact that there's 4 million displaced persons in Syria. There's 1 million displaced persons in Yemen. There are people getting on boats, dangerous boats from Libya. That's the true threat to Europe.
Yeah.
It's people that are coming in from around
the world. What about that?
Trying to find peace, trying to find a bit of ability to make some money and make a lifestyle.
Trying to save your ass.
And yet the United States and its cohorts in NATO continue to cause problems in spaces in the world that are the poorest countries in the world.
Yeah.
We're talking about the poorest country in the world is Yemen and Afghanistan. And
shit.
We're spending trillions of dollars to fight them as our enemies. And now we're going to have to create a new enemy, and that enemy will be Russia and China, which is very dangerous. But I really think that the fact of the matter is the victim in all this is the people of the world, the American taxpayer. It's time to wake up.
You know, Robert, this is one of the interesting and sad
things. They're not going to wake up, you idiot.
If you look at the greater Middle East from 2003 all the way to the present, is that every time the U.S. and its allies try to fix a problem there, they only make it worse, and then we have this law of unintended consequences. Libya is really one of the best, and we'll see it also in Syria. These neocons in Washington are never going to give up until they totally destroy the Assad regime. Then we'll have a true nightmare with ISIS there or something like ISIS, and then Europe is the next stop. But does the Europeans do anything about it? They just sit and watch and listen to what Washington does. Go ahead.
It's striking that France, which was not really directly integrated into NATO for 30 years, is now a part of NATO, and yet that is in some circles perceived as weakening the alliance.
Okay, let's go.
The broad sweep of,
bad news is back. Bad news is back. Yeah. Spending billions and billions and billions that we don't have. And who do we owe it to? International Monetary Fund? Who? There's not enough money. You couldn't print enough money to pay that debt, so what the hell's the story? Well, like I said before, my sign out front says, beware the crash of 2016. Tom Harmon, I have no confidence in him at all. His racial views suck. But I think a lot of his economic views are pretty much straight on. And he wrote a book called The Coming Crash of 2016. And even though you hate to make predictions like that because it's really risky, but I think he may be onto something there. Well, let's get some good news from jolly old Israel here. And how Nitwit doing? How the hell are you doing, Nitwit?
Prime Minister is struggling to form a new government after a former ally, the former foreign minister, Avigdor Lieberman, withdrew his support and left him short of a majority. Benjamin Netanyahu has until the end of Wednesday to present his new coalition to the president. Mike Hanna reports from West Jerusalem.
Israel's parliament has begun its summer session, but as yet there's still no government in place. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's Likud party has 30 seats, but he needs the backing of another 31 members to secure majority support in the 120-seat chamber. And it's largely because of this man that Netanyahu is struggling. Longtime ally Avigdor Lieberman announced earlier this week that he would not be part of the coalition, effectively taking six seats that Netanyahu so desperately needed to the opposition.
This proposed coalition does not reflect the demands of the national camp,
yeah,
and therefore I have decided to resign as foreign minister, and
clearly
we are not joining this coalition.
The major reason for Lieberman's desertion: Netanyahu's decision to include the ultra-Orthodox religious parties in his coalition. They demanded that
Netanyahu
granted the reinstatement of special
privileges,
state welfare payments to the Haredim or ultra-religious, an exclusion from mandatory military service for religious students. It was precisely these privileges that Lieberman and other secular members successfully fought against in the previous government.
In addition to the religious parties, Netanyahu has also signed a coalition agreement with Kalanu and promised the post of finance minister to its leader and former Likud member, Moshe Chalon. This gives him 53 seats. He still needs 8 to secure a majority.
Guess where he's going to get them? The settler party, the most radical right-wingers in Israel that have been building their houses on Palestinian land. Wow, man.
Prime Minister is struggling to form a new government after a former ally, the former foreign minister, Avigdor Liebman,
has also signed a coalition agreement with Kalanu and promised the post of finance minister to its leader and former Likud member, Moshe Chalon. This gives him 53 seats. He still needs 8 to secure a majority.
And this man controls exactly 8 seats. Naftali Bennett heads the Jewish Home Party, comprised mainly of settlers and regarded as extreme right-wing even in the Israeli political spectrum. And well aware of his present power as kingmaker, he's seeking a number of pledges from Netanyahu, not least the treasured position of justice minister.
Oh boy, it gets confusing. All this good news gets so confusing. Well, let's see what's going on with the good news about the bad news on water. People finally starting to think, oh, wasn't that Tom Metzger back in 1980 that said we needed a crash program to conserve water in California, in the Imperial Valley, in the San Joaquin Valley? We needed to change our way of using water for corporate agriculture and so forth. Oh, you didn't read that in the paper? Well, no, of course you didn't read it in the paper when I was running for Congress, because they didn't print the goddamn thing. That whore down there, Mrs. Copley, the San Diego Union, with her homosexual son, they wouldn't print a word of things like that. Well, it's caught up with us, and Mother Nature's going to bite our ass. So here we go. Here we go.
Scientist at Water Defense. Scott, thank you for joining us today.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for reaching out.
Obviously, I feel like we haven't done enough on this show to cover what's going on in California, the drought, the four-year-long drought, and the water crisis. You've released a specific study where you tested the wastewater at Chevron sites that it sells to farmers. Could you explain how Chevron's in the water business in the first place?
Yes. What Chevron does is they use a process called cyclic steam stimulation, and where they go deep beneath the earth, they drill down, they add a variety of chemicals that they've chosen not to disclose, and they generate for every gallon, something like 9 to 1, for every gallon of oil they produce, something like 9 gallons of water comes out of the ground, and that water's not useful in oil refining. And instead of having to haul it off or dispose of it, it's my understanding what they do is they take all this wastewater, attempt to filter it with walnut shells, and then dilute it, and then distribute it in irrigation canals where the agriculture industry uses it to irrigate, like almonds, tomatoes, oranges, and so on, you know, all the produce that we eat in this country. And I guess this area in Kern County is like where 90% of the world, not just the United States, but the world's almonds come from.
Now, you tested this water, and what did you find?
We found dangerous solvent chemicals, and basically these are chemicals known to be cancer-causing and very dangerous. And the chemicals in this water, if we were involved, if you and I had a gas station near this canal system and we were found that these chemicals were found in the water, we would be shut down and fined. So any other industry would be in having some deep problems if it were not oil related.
But to be clear, they're using this water to water crops with now.
Correct. And then all this water is being, this water is being used to water crops in Kern County, California, specifically the Coelho Water District.
Have you done testing to see if the chemicals end up in the actual plants that we're eating?
No, we have not. And there's a lot of unknowns around that. But the fact that it's in the water has raised the alarm bell, and we are talking to a variety of experts. We are not experts in the field of the actual crop testing.
This comes up because, obviously, California is facing a drought right now, and a severe one. And the water table is shrinking, and more, there are going to be people turning to companies like Chevron for this recycled water solutions, for water for human consumption, I assume, at some point.
Absolutely, absolutely. I want to point out another significant point here. It's the health, and you can smell, we can't capture this on video or the written words, the smell of in the air, being out there on the ground, you get dizzy. And you get quite nauseous being around the smell, and health and human safety and the concern for the workers in the, you know, in the agricultural industry. They're exposed to this stuff, you know, 8, 12, 16 hours a day. And it's not healthy for these chemicals to be in the water, period.
Obviously, somebody should be regulating this. Who's responsible for that?
The California regulators, the elected officials. Therein is that is the million-dollar question right there that you just asked, is who is responsible. It is actually the elected officials and the regulators. And the oil companies are simply complying with 40-year-old regulations at this point that have not been updated. So in a lot of ways, the regulation system and our elected officials have failed the stakeholders in California.
How does this need to change? What needs to be updated? What does the state government in California need to do? And do there need to be federal rules around this? Because I assume if it's being done by Chevron in California, it's going to be done nationally at some point.
Correct. What needs to be done is our regulations need to be put in place in a transparent way. Regular testing and testing methods that actually are work to detect the chemicals need to be put in place. And they need to be put in place like yesterday, which it's actually pretty easy to do what's necessary to be done here.
Explain what is necessary.
What is necessary, for example, is a testing method. Right now, the testing method that we used out there is like, let's say you have a house, you have a video, you have a security camera, and you have a 10-hour period. You're videoing the whole time, so you can see the burglar entering your house. You identify him. Now, in that 10-hour period, if you had also next to the video camera a regular picture with stills, and you took three pictures over that 10-hour period, you don't see the burglar entering your house. That's the difference between the water testing methodology we use is the video camera versus the conventional testing with the still camera. It is known you're going to get a quote non-detect. You're not going to see the burglar entering your house. And what the regulators and the oil companies are doing is the testing methods they're used take that quick snapshot or a split second of that water instead of looking at the water over a period of time and monitoring what is traveling, what is in that water, because contamination is not constant. These contaminants, you may have a period of time where you're flowing throughout the day, you know, 20, 30 minutes without any contamination, and then all of a sudden a bunch of contamination is introduced into the water.
With all the agriculture going on in California, you've tested this one county. How widespread is this practice outside of that county?
Based on the calls I'm getting as a result of the LA Times article, I would say it's much more widespread than I thought throughout the whole Central Valley. I don't know the details, but we have a lot of people reaching out, and we plan to follow up and do testing wherever we can to get more information. The interesting thing is, I've been in over 50 disasters, everything since BP. When I originally got the call last August, I thought, well, California, you know, that California had the perception that they're leaders, and there's no way there could be contaminated oil wastewater being used to irrigate. I didn't believe it myself until I actually went there on the ground.
We are talking with Scott Smith, chief scientist at Water Defense, about their study where they found that Chevron was using contaminated water to irrigate crops and injecting it into our irrigation systems. What, I mean, there's an overarching problem, which is California's running out of water, right? So how do you confront that at the same time?
Well, you have to, you know, California's running out of water, and you look at the ratio, something like 9 to 1 for every gallon of oil. There's 9 gallons of water used. To me, it's the simplicity of the mathematics. And in California, the question has to be asked, is it worth it? I mean, is it really worth using all this water in the oil industry? And that question has to be asked, and the impact of the community, no matter what side of that, whether you're part of the oil industry, whether you're not, it's time to bring people together and just ask the question and say, is it worth it? Is there another way to supply our energy needs?
Plus, I mean, there are, you know, you have Carly Fiorina out there saying it's environmentalist fault that California is running out of water, which just seems ridiculous at this point.
It is. You know, all this finger pointing, I want to point out, whether it's from the environmental movement or Carly Fiorina or the oil companies, the finger pointing is pointless because the lives of our children are at stake. And it's really time for environmentalists and American businesses to come together and solve the pollution problems. This is really, it's almost like the tobacco industry. It is hard for us to believe at this point that there were actually studies by the cigarette companies way back when that smoking was actually good or didn't cause cancer. We are now at the same point with the health of the future generations right now, because all these denials going on about what's really in the water, well, learning from the tobacco industry would be a lot easier right now for the elected officials, regulators, and oil companies to just work together with everybody and acknowledge the problem instead of having to shell out billions or trillions 10, 15 years down the road when the real impact of this wastewater is going to hit people.
What are the health effects of these chemicals on people?
Well, you know, I work with trained toxicologists. I'm not a toxicologist, but I can tell you from what I talk to the experts about, you know, liver damage, kidney, endocrine disruption. You know, you're exposed to these volatiles. Every human's different. It's cancer-causing. Those are all very serious health effects. And those are exposures. There are people working in the fields in agriculture that are exposed to these volatiles. And the thing is that there's still a lot more we don't know than we know. But we know enough right now that we have a serious issue here, and we need to monitor this, and we need to launch a lot more studies as to.
Well, is that enough good, bad news for you? We got more. Oh, hell yes. We've always got more good, bad news for you. So I got something else I want to play for you about. What do the Palestinians think about these Ethiopian niggers? The Ethiopian niggers get invited into Israel. Come on down here, you know, but the Palestinians are trying to shove them out. Well, there seems to be some racism going on over there in Israel. Now, the audio on that last one was a little rough, but I've got tape recorders all over this place, and when something comes on, I got to run for the first one I can get a hold of to record the good bad news. Well, that bit was on a black radio station, and I was half asleep when I tried to record it. I know I've got it around here, but anyhow, it had to do with these black guys talking about the racism in Israel, going on and on about the racism in Israel, how the Israelis over there call the Negroes nasty names all over Israel, Jerusalem, and all over the place. So anyhow, it was pretty interesting, and the attitude about the Palestinians. And so it leaves you to understand that Palestinians don't like the Negroes either, because they don't know which side the Negroes are on. Well, let's pick up on A Man Called Lucy again. We got a little bit more in this book to read you. And I think you've had enough of the good bad news for the day. Okay. And I'm really happy that some of my contacts, including Louis Beam, who evidently is over there in Russia now, took my advice and got a hold of this book, A Man Called Lucy, and they were quite impressed, I understand. Well, that's good. I try to bring these people up on educating, you know. I try to do that. Okay. Even though I'm just a country boy out here. I know Louis Beam's a country boy, too. I wonder how he's doing over there in Moscow. I hope he don't fall for everything that Putin may tell him. Yeah. Reminds me of the time I was invited to go over to see Gaddafi. Ooh, what year was that? I can't remember right now, but Canadians put it together, and they asked me if I wanted to go, and I was getting ready to go, but then I had a court date in L.A. or some screwball deal, so I wasn't able to go. Probably a good thing, because they never got to meet Gaddafi. There's a nigger contingent went over there, black radicals. He met with them, but he didn't meet with the white boys. And incidentally, there was a guy who got murdered over there in the process. One of the news guys, I think, got pushed off the top of a building and killed. I never did know how that came out, so it's probably a good thing I didn't go on over there, because I wouldn't have met Gaddafi anyhow. During the weeks that followed, Masson grew more apprehensive about the larger significance of these curious encounters and shared his forebodings with his superior. Gusan had received detailed reports of the two meetings Masson had had with Schellenberg. I remember Schellenberg was the replacement for Heydrich. And Heydrich was smart and part Jewish, but Schellenberg was even smarter. He had written them up himself so no one else would know of their contents. This Schellenberg was, he warned, entirely too elusive. His cautious cat-like manner of approach revealed that he set great store by whatever he hoped to find in Switzerland. He had tried to entangle Masson in an inextricable net of obligations. Now, Masson, you see, was chief of security for Switzerland. He had obviously decided, and Switzerland was not neutral. They can call themselves neutral all they wanted, but they really weren't. He had obviously decided to ask for what he wanted only when he met that Masson could refuse him nothing. There was still time to get out, and Masson told General Gassin quite categorically that he ought to do so. But while recommending the greatest caution, Gassin insisted on the importance of preserving so valuable a contact. As the year 1942 was coming to an end, Switzerland could not neglect anything that would increase her chances of survival. In general, the situation was not very promising. Switzerland had shown many signs of Allied sympathy. Its anti-aircraft defense, even its fighters, which had been so effective in preventing the Luftwaffe from flying over its territory in 1940, somehow never managed to intercept the thick waves of British bombers that violated Swiss airspace on their way to sow destruction in Germany and northern Italy. Which brings me another question. Hitler, I was talking to you yesterday about Hitler hanging out down there at the Berghof in the Alps. With all these bombers running around there, why wasn't one of those bombers sent over there to bomb the hell out of Berghof? I mean, these bombers were overflying, and it would seem to me that it would have been a lot more effective if one of those bombers, even on a suicide mission, if they really wanted to get Hitler, because they would know, because he always flew the swastika flag on top of the Berghof when he was there. Just simply, sort of take off and go over Switzerland and bomb the hell out of the Berghof. I don't know whether they ever thought of that. It was also a common occurrence, despite blackout orders from the Army High Command, for Swiss towns to light up accidentally when Allied planes were passing overhead, thus unwittingly acting as guide lights. Some neutral country, huh? Hitler should have taken Switzerland. Strategically, he should have taken Switzerland. Moreover, Switzerland had long been secretly banking on the ultimate Allied victory. Despite the surveillance of Germany, which had the country completely encircled, Switzerland had continued to mail to London large quantities of parcels weighing about 4 pounds each that contained spare parts for watches, which could also be used as explosive mechanisms. But these gestures did not satisfy the Allies. They wanted more. The British blockade of Switzerland continued. For some months, they had allowed, through a small number of shipments, essentially to Switzerland's survival. Then even this tiny artery was stopped. The Allies criticized the Confederation for continuing to trade with Germany, refusing to admit that she had no alternative. She obtained the coal, iron, mineral oil, gasoline, sugar, and alcohol that she needed, and in exchange she supplied Germany with Gruyere, Emmental, butter, and meat, as well as certain industrial products, such as machine tools, and sometimes weapons, parts, and munitions. These last were purchased by Walter Kruger, the assistant of German military attaché in Bern, and a man highly trusted by the German Army High Command. Every day in every railway station, secret British supervisors took careful note of everything that left Switzerland and of its destination, and others visited factories and made the most intolerable investigations. Masson assistants had tracked them down but done nothing to stop them. A British blockade would not really embarrass the Confederation. If there were shortages, the government would ask its farmers to make greater efforts. This was nothing new. In March 1938, an unknown agronomist, F.T. Whelan, was asked to make an official estimate of the potential production of the country's agriculture. And 2 years later, he had come up with a detailed plan of action. As a result, stony ground was cleared, marshes drained, and barren land made fertile. Woods were cut down and parks and gardens cleared. Every available space of ground was sown with seed. This enormous enterprise, based on an exact calculation of calories and vitamins, was a complete success. The area of cultivated land rose from 467,500 to 915,000 acres. Even more could still be done. Boy, that was about double. Wow. No, Gassin was worried on another account. What were the real reasons for the Allies' irritation? The transit across Switzerland of German trains destined for Italy? That and the loans granted by the Swiss to Germany. But Gassin was helpless to do anything about the secret activities of the Swiss banks. At the end of the war, the Allies were to claim that the gold stolen by the Germans in Europe and transferred to Switzerland was worth about 800 million French francs, 1945 francs. On January 5, 1943, through the press, the Allies had urged all neutral countries, including Switzerland, not to accept this stolen gold, which at the time totaled something like 585 million. This appeal was repeated by the Americans on February 23, 1944. But the Swiss banks do not appear to have paid any attention. They don't pay much attention today either. So already suspecting in 1942 that the end of the war would present his country with a number of awkward problems, and very probably fearing that Switzerland might be able to assuage the bitterness bound to be shown her, Gassin preferred not to lose contact with this German who stated that he wished to negotiate with the Allies. If Schellenberg succeeded, the Confederation would benefit. Such a success might even redound in part of his own credit. The Swiss frontiers would be open for Schellenberg whenever he wanted to come. All that was necessary was for him to be watched closely. So here's Schellenberg, head of the OKW, German intelligence, passing freely back and forth between Germany and Switzerland. But at the same time, the Swiss were really voiding their neutrality by doing a lot of other things. So what a basket of eels. On October 18, 1942, when Schellenberg arrived back in Berlin, the war was raging on all fronts, and no one could predict its outcome. The Americans had just involved themselves in an uncertain battle at Guadalcanal in the Pacific. Violent but uncertain battles were being waged in the industrial districts of Stalingrad. For his part, Schellenberg knew that more than ever before, Switzerland had to act with the greatest prudence and dare not antagonize Germany. Moreover, he was convinced that he fully understood the way the Swiss reasoned. Switzerland, he believed, was a timid country, so apprehensive that whenever it thought fit to concede something to one side, it always felt obliged to follow it up once by concession to the other side. It was true that the certain Swiss industrialists were unwilling to deliver arms to the Wehrmacht, but the Swiss banks preserved their customary discretion, placing their numbered safes at the disposal of anonymous customers, which was extremely useful when one wanted to hide stolen wealth. Switzerland had also an irritating tolerance towards French and British spies, and a no less marked hostility toward German secret agents. But it did allow the right 300 million Swiss francs per year as trade between the two countries. Slightly favored the Confederation, which was something of a consolidation. But what really convinced him that the Swiss were anxious to remain on the Germans' good side was the utter callousness, in complete contradiction to Switzerland's professed humanitarianism, that the federal consul displayed towards the Jews who asked for asylum. Ever since 1939, the Confederation had been playing an incredible, dangerous game. Colonel Victor Henry, the Swiss Commission for Internment, rendered innumerable services to members of the French resistance, but remained absolutely intransigent towards these refugees. The fact that Schellenberg could not help feeling was another example of their usual balancing act, and would be used to counter the suspected treason he was investigating. As far as that French resistance, it's come out long after the war, of course, that the French resistance was almost totally Jews. Almost totally occupied by Jews, the French resistance. In his talks with the British Secret Service in 1945, he made the following statement that startling illuminates one of the most disturbing episodes in Switzerland's conduct during the war. Quote, "In exchange for their participation in your victory, the Swiss, or at least some of the Swiss leaders, sacrificed thousands of human lives to Hitler's madness." Not, of course, Swiss lives, but those of desperate men and women who came and asked for asylum, Jews, perhaps 100,000. They were turned away, thrown back into the hands of my countrymen, who sent them off to the concentration camps, unquote. You see, countries did this all over the place. A lot of them claimed their hands were clean on the Jewish question. That's bullshit. Coming from an SS general, this statement is somewhat surprising, but it must not be forgotten that in 1945, Schellenberg, too, tried to buy his life in exchange for his disclosures to the British. In writing this chapter, the authors checked Schellenberg's statements against an official document written in 1953 at the request of the federal consul by Carl Ludwig, a professor from Basel. It was a private report intended only for the Swiss deputies, but some of them, moved by threats from Jewish international organizations, guess who, to cause public scandal, brought the affair out into the open. It was only on October 10, 1942, that Schellenberg learned of the extent of the measures taken by the Swiss against the Jewish refugees. He was astonished to hear that the day before, General Gusin had ordered the 1st and 4th Army Corps to reinforce the frontiers in the sectors of Geneva and Blasvelis. In fact, on October 10th, the 1st Army Corps began sealing these zones off with barbed wire, forming a no-man's land between Switzerland and France. Quote, "an opportunity intended only to prevent Jews from entering the country," unquote. The Bureau F in Bern explained to Schellenberg, quote, "open a dossier on the problem," quote, he replied. The inquiry conducted by the German agents in Switzerland went back to 39, to the first day of the war. The Confederation had long calculated that 25 cantons of the country would not be economically capable of supporting the 7,000 aliens and 7,100 refugees had already been granted asylum since 33. Even before the thousands of refugees began beating against its walls, Switzerland had declared it had reached its limit and was unable to take any more. Get on out of here, Jew boy. It was not with indignation he would have tended rather than to approve, but with curiosity that Schellenberg wondered how Switzerland had managed to accept no more than 308 refugees, almost entirely Jews, between September 39 and January 42. Great humanitarians. Switzerland had shown mercy to these 308 refugees, mainly German and Dutch Jews. As a sop to the consciences of a number of national councillors, including Mag and Rittenmeyer, who had begun to voice their disquiet. After January 42, the numbers of Jews who appeared every day at the Swiss frontier and were sent back after being caught trying to crowd their way through the police posts increased markedly. Between January and April 42, 82 had succeeded in being admitted. At the end of July, there were 850 in all, of whom 335 were Dutch. Then came the massive deportations organized by the Germans throughout Europe, and the danger became acute for all the Jews. They rushed towards Switzerland, but were turned back. Two methods were used to expel the unwanted refugees. One, they could be smuggled back across the border, where they had 1 in 10 chances of escaping recapture, but at least had some chance of survival. The second method was nothing less than a simple condemnation. The refugee was handed over to the police of the country from which he had come. This method, used more frequently, gave rise to some very embarrassing scenes. To escape this fate, many refugees preferred to kill themselves at the frontiers. Professor Ludwig's federal report on the Swiss policy towards refugees contains this brief accusatory note. Quote, they often committed suicide at the feet of the Swiss soldiers in order not to fall into the hands of the Germans, unquote. Humanitarian Swiss, how about that? Not this dramatic fact, but the sharp increase in the numbers of refugees at the Swiss frontiers since July 30, 42, alarmed Herr Rothman, head of the federal police. Jews were still getting through from the French side of the Jura Mountains, and Rothman asked for motorized formation to patrol the frontiers. The federal consul granted his request. On August 4th, he ordered the rejection of refugees should continue to be strictly observed, unquote. Even if it results in serious risk to these persons, that is, injury or death. He followed this up with by decreeing, in the face of all the information reaching him, that the Jews were in no serious danger in Europe at all. Well, maybe that was true. Swiss Jewish organizations protested, but Rothman dismissed their pleas. Quote, he must be content to look after the Jews we already have saved. In any case, the German officials have assured me that the detainees in these camps are only made to work. They are not harshly treated. There can be no question of rescinding our decrees. Switzerland will remain closed to the Jews, unquote. The agitation reached the federal council, where a serious internal crisis was predicted and the decisions of the council were retained. The Socialist Party and the Federation of Protestant Churches added their protests. Finally, the frontiers were ordered to open to pregnant women, young children, and the very old. But 14 days later, Herr Rothman terrified the authorities by revealing that in less than a month, 1,000 new refugees had been arrested for entering the country illegally. The federal council was not alone in its intransigent attitude. The vast majority of cantons were just as severe towards the refugees. The sole exception was the canton of the city of Basel. Although it had taken a great many refugees before the war, it declared it was willing to accept more. When their humane attitude became known, other cantons did not hesitate to get rid of their own refugees by leaving them in the Basel marketplace. like the one state, that'd be like, one of the states, the United States, saying, we'll take them in, and all the rest of the states put them on trucks and take them over there. Interesting. Others acted even more cynically. They warned the unwanted refugees that if they were found on the Canton's territory after nightfall, they would be sent into Germany that night, thus saving the price of transport. The refugees had no alternative but to try and seek refuge in Basel. Herr Rothman had no difficulty, therefore, getting the Confederation's support, and on October 9th, the Federal Council asked the General Gesine to take over responsibility for patrolling the frontiers, as Walter Schellenberg was duly informed by his agents. From October 42 onward, Schellenberg never ceased to keep account of Switzerland's behavior towards the refugees. In the debt column, he wrote that a number of refugees accepted by Switzerland. In the credit column, those that had turned away and who had been caught by his SS colleagues. The Swiss federal authorities, of course, simply reversed the headings, placing to their credit those who had been saved from the Nazis. Between September 39 and October 42, hypocrisy is still the world sport. It's not just a national sport. Hypocrisy is a world sport. And they never cease to use it. Between September 39 and October 42, 4,700 refugees had been granted asylum by the Confederation. On December 31, 1942, there were 9,100. At the end of the war, adding together civilian refugees and military internees and German and Allied deserters, Switzerland reached a total of 100,000 refugees. But approximately an equal number of refugees were turned away at the frontiers, giving the alternative of either suicide or arrest by the SS. Another fact confirmed Schellenberg in his hypothesis. The surprising silence of the Swiss authorities concerning their knowledge of the atrocities in the concentration camps. Paradoxically, as it may seem, until 1944, when the fate of Germany had been finally sealed, the Swiss appeared to know nothing of the genocide being practiced by the Nazis. Well, maybe it wasn't. However, Walter Schellenberg knew that this was not so. In October 42, Herr Rothman visited the concentration camp at Orenburg. There was a certain curiosity, in the words of his own, that Schellenberg awaited the reactions of the head of the federal police. He was not disappointed. In a statement to the federal council, Herr Rothman said, quote, I must admit that the Jews are not treated with much consideration in this camp. But nothing led me to believe that they were being executed in mass there either, unquote. However, 7 months prior to Rothman's visit, Switzerland had officially been informed by reliable witnesses, probably Jews, that the Germans organized mass executions in their concentration camps. After one such report, the informant was ordered to remain silent and never to repeat what he had just said, but he talked and was later reproached for having violated professional secrecy. The Swiss knew there were other informers. In vain, the federal authorities tried to muzzle their newspapers. Schellenberg was absolutely certain that their callous treatment of the Jewish refugees was something the Swiss could cast into the scales of counterbalance should the Germans ever discover the role they were playing with the Allies. Yes, he had every reason to feel satisfied. Schellenberg knew that the contact with Switzerland could not be broken, that the Swiss were well aware of the strength of the Reich and need to maintain relations with Germany. A month after Schellenberg's return to Berlin, a new complication arose, the sudden appearance of Alan Dulles, the grandson of the American missionary in India. Dulles had attended the École Alsace in Paris before going on to Princeton. He then became a schoolteacher, first in India, then in China. In 1916, he joined the diplomatic service, and as early as 1917, was spying on Austria and Germany from Bern. When President Roosevelt appointed Major General William J. Donovan head of the Office of Strategic Service, In December 41, it was quite natural for Donovan to ask Dulles to work with him. Dulles apparently began to work in Switzerland shortly after the Allied landing in Morocco and Algeria, although only the Swiss authorities knew exactly when he had crossed the frontiers of the Confederation. In any case, he did so at some time before November, since he entered Switzerland from the Free Zone of France, Vichy France. Unofficial sources had suggested that he had been in the country since the spring of 42. No one suspected that a special envoy from Roosevelt, one who enjoyed the president's full confidence, had been operating all this time incognito in Switzerland. And anonymity had enabled Dulles to get a more exact idea of the people who might be able to help him. First, he would depend on complete unconditional support from the Swiss themselves. General Gassin, Brigadier General Masson, and the entire Swiss Secret Service agreed to cooperate with him and the American government. He had also approached a number of French resistance workers who had agreed to act as sources. But Dulles wanted more than that. He also wanted to gain the cooperation of Germans, not just any Germans, but representatives of a true, sincere opposition to Nazism. When Dulles discovered that the Swiss were working with such a group, he attempted to bypass them and contact him himself. This was the only thing the Swiss refused him. However, in the end, they did reveal that they knew and dealt with only one member of the network, the leader himself, who had been living in Switzerland for a long time. They knew nothing, of course, about Werther and Olga, these two other agents. It was then that Alan Dulles decided to announce his intentions to the world. Almost immediately, his house in the Herrengrasse in Zurich, his flat in Schweizerhof in Lucerne, and his flat in Jubiläumstrasse in Bern became very popular places. Dulles had failed to contact the opposition to Hitler by secret means. He now hoped that they would contact him. Strangely enough, some of them, the less serious, did, as if the Gestapo or the SD did not exist in Switzerland. The first to reveal himself was Hans Bern Gazeville, the enormous German vice consul in Zurich, an ex-police administrator from the early days of Nazism, the permanent special envoy of Canaris, the traitor and abwehr to the Confederation. H.B. Gazeville and Alan Dulles met frequently, almost daily, at critical periods. Gazeville's mission was to communicate to the Americans messages from General Ludwig Beck and Karl Gordeler, the moving spirits behind the conspiracy that organized the July plot, and to keep the United States informed about attempts against the Führer. At first, Gazeville tried to conceal his visits. One evening, as they were dining together in Bern, Dulles Cook, who did not yet know the vice consul, noticed that the two men were speaking in German. She examined the guest's hat and found his initials, HBG. That night she informed the German embassy. 2 days later, when Gazeville went to his embassy for routine business, he was accused of treason by two senior officials. Gazeville rebuked them soundly. Of course he visited Dulles, and he had excellent reason for doing so. Dulles was quite simply his best espionage source among the Allies. He added that if the two officials wished to keep their jobs, they had better forget what they had just heard. Dulles thus learned that his cook was a Nazi spy, and Gazeville realized that a secret agent never displayed his initials on his hat band. This is an excellent frustration of the extraordinary atmosphere in Switzerland at the time. Almost everyone appeared to be working for some secret service or another. Ironically, this provided an admirable smokescreen for the few really important agents. If the game he played with Gazeville seemed somewhat naive, Dulles himself was not. He had the difficult task in persuading the plotting generals around Beck and Canaris. All of them wanted a separate peace and sometimes suggested the most bizarre plans for disposing of Hitler, that Britain and the United States would never turn on the Soviet Union so long as the war continued. For example, Beck suggested that the following plan, which he had communicated to Dulles through Clivius, quote, the British and the Americans land in Western Europe. The German generals then send all their troops west to meet the attack. The Western Allies then send three divisions of paratroopers to land on Berlin to help the plotters hold the capital. Meanwhile, dependable anti-Nazi group troops are sent to seize Hitler in the mountain hideout on the Obersalzberg. The war then continues against the Russians, unquote. Interesting. So there were several plans to attack Hitler's house down in the mountains. Probably some of them didn't even know. Dulles had the greatest difficulty in bringing the conspirators down to earth. However, his sudden emergence on November 42 had one result that he could not have foreseen. As soon as Walter Schellenberg learned from his agents in Bern and Zurich that Guiseville, one of his favorite suspects, was flirting with the Americans, he abandoned his earlier theory. He felt his quarry would be most likely to work for both the Russians and the Americans. For despite the fact that they were now allies, the Americans made no secret of their violent anti-communism. Schellenberg had to reconsider this problem, since the men he sought no longer appeared to be among the usual plotters. He would turn to the Swiss. Anything now seemed possible. The Confederation might be totally unaware that the Russians were using its territory as a radio-telegraphic relay station, but it was equally possible that this tiny nation might be running an espionage network that had its roots in the heart of the Reich in Berlin. There was only one way to find out. A trap had to be laid, a trap such as Schellenberg excelled at elaborating. Meanwhile, in Stalingrad, the myth of invincibility of the Wehrmacht was collapsing. Since November 23rd, Beethoven, Zhukov, Eremenko, and Rakowski had surrounded Paulus and his 6th Army, and the Germans had already lost 140,000 men out of 400,000 in the front of Stalingrad, which, like I said, they're stupid to waste their time at Stalingrad. They should have went directly to Moscow. As Lucy had predicted, both the Russians and the Bureau HA, the Italian, Hungarian, Romanian legions spread out over 340 miles from the Voronezh to the Stalingrad, had not held their ground. See, these troops from these smaller Eastern European nations, they just couldn't carry the water any more than the Italians could. Their lines had been, sorry boys, it's just the way it is, you know. It was there west of Paulus's troops that the Russian grip had inexorably tightened. One last slender hope remained, the 6th and 17th and the 23rd Tank Divisions under Hoth, which had gone south to the Caucasus while speeding back to attempt to break the formidable pressure from the Red Army. Paulus was to be alerted to make a breakthrough. Only an element of surprise could win the day. But of course, Moscow was kept informed through intelligence supplied by Lucy down in Switzerland of the advance of Hoth's 3 divisions on their degree of freshness and the morale among those troops. They were beginning to show signs of exhaustion. They made a stop in Vasilichia, hardly 30 miles from their goal. Gasoline was running short and new supplies had been held up 60 miles away. The Russians chose this moment, this pause before the planned German attack. The 51st and the 67th Armies and full contingent of a Group 2 hurled themselves on the German tanks, decimating them. Hoth retreated, thoroughly beaten. There was no more hope for Paulus. Hitler abandoned him, conferring on him the rank of Field Marshal. He was not told this, of course. On the contrary, he was informed that a rescue force formed at Kursov was on its way from the west. Paulus was to grit his teeth, wait, and stand up to the Russians as best he could. From the west came nothing but death administered by the Red Army. Once more, information reaching Moscow via Lucy uncovered the Germans' bluff. Rakowski sent an ultimatum to Paulus, who rejected it. believing perhaps in the reinforcements that were supposed to be coming from Kharkov. As the beginning of this campaign in 42, the Russian loudspeakers announced the truth to the Wehrmacht troops, stripping away their last illusions. Then, knowing that they would meet with little resistance, 7 Soviet armies, 60 shock divisions went to work. The cold weather, eternal ally of the Russians, made matters worse for the Germans. Very little, and remember, they had a hard time getting winter clothes up to the German troops because Hitler didn't seem to care about it. He wouldn't be bothered with it. But Goebbels went into the streets of Germany in Berlin and had all the women gather up all their fur coats and all warm coats and truck them to the east for the troops. It's an interesting thing. Hitler, by this time, is either drugged up too much or he just too narcissistic to give a shit. Sorry, boys. You Hitler lovers. Very little Wehrmacht blood flowed that day. It was frozen in the bodies of the dead. On December 25, 1942, General Gusan celebrated Christmas with the 2nd Light Infantry Regiment in the public square at Arburg. Neither he nor his compatriots knew of the plans that Walter Schellenberg was meanwhile presenting to Heinrich Himmler for approval. Schellenberg could not have failed to notice the profound change that had come over his superior in the past months. Himmler's shoulders seemed to droop, and his eyes, hidden behind thick glasses, protruded more than ever. His upper lip twitched intermittently. Nervously, he turned and twisted the famous green pencil which he used to annotate all the reports that passed through his pudgy fingers, and with which he so often signed orders for the extermination of Jews. Quote, "Are you sure the plan will be a success, Schellenberg?" "I'll take responsibility for it," Schellenberg said. "And you're sure Canaris, Beck, and their gang are not behind it?" Quote, "I'm convinced of it, Reichsfuhrer. We can go on playing with them," unquote. It was one of the strangest, most surprising facts about this period that Himmler and Schellenberg were always knew in advance every detail of the plots to assassinate Hitler. What was more, once Himmler realized that his SS, he was virtually in command of the situation in Germany, he sometimes went even so far as to lend them his passive support. Indeed, the opposition sought such support and actually offered Himmler in the Führer's place. The Wehrmacht refused to act without him, but Himmler equivocated, hoping for a more favorable opportunity, and in the end he missed his chance. Himmler was delighted with Schellenberg's plan to trick his subordinate, intended to play on the Swiss for very much of his taste. How amply Schellenberg had justified his encouragement, he had proved a most able successor to Reinhard Heydrich. A week later, Himmler entered the Führer's headquarters. Goering, Goebbels, Rosenberg, and Bormann, who he detested, were all there. He requested that the OKW swiftly draw up a plan to invade Switzerland. Hitler observed Himmler intently. What he undoubtedly wondered lay behind the latest plan. Was it part of some vast scheme directed against his personal enemies? Why, Switzerland, the 6th Army, was dying in Russia, and it was even possible that the entire Wehrmacht in the East would collapse. Hitler had too much on his mind to concern himself with a pygmy like Switzerland. However, Himmler must have his reasons for proposing the invasion, and the Führer gave the desired approval. Next morning, the order arrived in Zossen, the permanent headquarters of the Oberkommando of the Wehrmacht. For 2 weeks, nothing was done about it. Then, when a command directed from the Führer arrived, the commissions immediately set to work. On Saturday, January 30th, at 9 a.m., Rudolf Rösler, Lucy, arrived at the Villa Stutz. He seemed preoccupied. The night before, Werther had informed him that the OKW was preparing plans for an invasion of Switzerland under General Detaille, a specialist in winter and mountain operations. The same report specified that Detaille's force, consisting of armored units, paratroopers, and Alpine troops, was training near Munich. This was certainly a bombshell for Masson and Gesine. Yet, curiously enough, Roessler felt there was something wrong with this information. It failed to jibe with what he was certain must be the concerns of the Nazi leaders at the time. He confided his doubts to Christian Schneider. 600 miles away in Berlin, Walter Schallenberg waited anxiously for the results of the trap he and Himmler had set. He expected the Swiss to lie down, at least for a while, but they were involved in this extraordinary affair, and he believed they would come out of hiding soon enough. Throughout the Confederation, his spies redoubled their efforts, ordered to observe all Swiss movements, particularly close, at the slightest sign of any unusual activity on the other side of the Rhine. Schellenberg would have his proof that one of the several spies were to be found within the OKW, and that they were passing information to the Swiss, who in turn informed the Allies. And that's the end of the reading today. I think we've got one or maybe two more chapters left in this book. And boy, it reveals a lot. It reveals a lot if you're a thinking guy. And you better be a thinking guy, because the time is coming where you're going to have to outfox a lot of people and not be taken in by anybody. And not trust anybody, totally. You can have some trust, but hand it out judiciously. I'm serious about this. 14.5. An example of this is that Dennis Mahon in prison was doing pretty good, and a guy handed him a simple little paper with a joke about blacks on it. And Dennis took it to his cell. All of a sudden, they're throwing his cell upside down. Whoop. Whoa, 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 whoa. Berlin calling. Can you believe that? Some damn drunk called on my cell phone. Jeez. Anyhow, so Dennis, he's always too trusting this guy. That's what got him in the jam in the first place. So they turned his cell upside down, and I don't think he failed to understand what goes on in prison. You can't trust anybody. You can't trust people on the outside, but you can't trust anybody on the inside. And I think he was set up. So I tell these guys, don't accept things from other prisoners like that. If I send you something, it's just to you. And don't share it with other prisoners unless, well, just don't do it. Because Mahon is sitting in solitary confinement now for a few months, simply for taking that. It was nothing strategic, nothing violent, nothing even hardly racist. It was just a joke about blacks, you know, which the guards tell each other all the time. Anyhow, that's an example of security. You've got to have security. You've got to keep your mouth shut. See, the way they got him there is thinking that it's just a joke and just a minor thing that, most of the people in prison know about. It wouldn't cause him any problem. Nope, they just use it as an excuse to tear his cell to pieces and throw him in solitary. And if you ever get into prison or jail, remember that. Anytime they put a person in the cell with you, he's an informant. That's one thing to remember. And probably since Mahon had a cellie, that he was an agent snitch all the time, his cellie too. Anyhow, you can lead horses to the water, but you can't make them drink. 14.5.